No. You know, people are in the lobby in their pajamas.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order.
Fine.
Today is March 18th. We are, unfortunately, our good chair is out sick today, so I will be chairing this session of the committee. We'll be opening a public hearing today on House Bill 3411 as well as House Bill 2472, both relating to the to tax credits and specifically to the business energy tax credit. And I, Chris, do you want to start us off here?
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As you recall, House Bill 2472 had a blank in the bill, but the theme there was to put a cap on the amount of BETC credits that could be issued in a year. And the general response to that bill was not positive. So as a result of that, there was a work group that was formed to work on the issues that the bill was intended to get at. And so the people on that work group were Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, Vice Chair Benz, Mike Greeney from the Department of Energy, and Tim McKay from the Economic Development Department. And then the culmination of that work group is at least where it stands now. The result from that work group is currently in House Bill 3411. And so you have that in your packet, and you also have a few memos from Mike Graney that I believe the committee will hear from him shortly about those memos. But to just touch briefly on what is currently in House Bill 3411, it establishes grounds for the mandatory denial of preliminary certifications for certain projects exceeding $5 million in cost for certain criteria. And those criteria are that the applicant comply with all state and local requirements necessary for licenses and permits, they be up to date in any taxes owed to the state or local governments, and that they keep the facility in continuous operation for at least 5 years. And it would also, 3411, allow the Department of Energy to require these conditions to be met for final certification, as well as enabling them to revoke a certificate if the conditions fail to be met. It would also allow the Department of Energy to deny preliminary certification for criteria or to consider criteria for the number of jobs created, the economic benefits, the environmental impact, and the revenue impact as compared with the projected benefits and whether or not the construction of the facility is dependent upon preliminary certification. It would also allow the Department of Energy to consider multiple applications as a single application for certain purposes if the facilities are so closely related to as constitute a single facility. And so that's what's currently in 3411, and that meshes somewhat with the three memos that you have in your packet from Mike Graney.
Director Graney, love to hear from you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. And let me elaborate a little bit on Chris's summary of both the bill and some of the other amendments that the work group asked us to prepare, and those are reflected in the memos you have. That we don't have amendment language yet. Backing up, I think in spite of the fact that we feel strongly that there have been very important benefits of the Business Energy Tax Credit Program, or the BETC as it's called, there have been larger revenue impacts than anticipated, and clearly with the revenue situation the legislature is facing this year, a strong desire to reduce the revenue impacts of the program while maintaining the program's effectiveness. House Bill 3411 is part of the package of amendments that the Revenue Committee's Joint Revenue Committee's work group has discussed to reduce these revenue impacts. Let me first mention that House Bill 3411 itself would apply to all projects over $5 million except for solar and other renewable energy manufacturing facilities. These larger projects, which are primarily wind, but also some industrial cogeneration and occasionally a large conservation project, only represent 1% of our projects by volume, by number of projects, but 75% of the revenue impact. So clearly focusing on these, I think, can help us achieve the committee's goals. The specific measures that Chris mentioned, I think, are laid out clearly in the bill in 3411 that would give us, importantly, the discretion to evaluate these large projects and to assure that the state is getting the economic benefits, the bang for the buck, that for these large investments. Three other amendments that the committee, well, let me first mention that we estimate that these measures in 3411 would reduce the revenue impacts from new projects by 5 to 10%. There are three other measures, and those are reflected in the memos. One is that current law allows a 10% overrun between preliminary certification the department issues before a project is built and the final certification, that's the actual tax credit document after a project is finished. And that's to reflect the fact that costs do exceed estimates, and particularly for larger projects that take a longer period of time. But I think, again, in this time of the need for state revenues to be focused, this is a provision that should be eliminated. Since most of the large projects have been taking advantage of this, this would likely reduce the revenue impacts by another 10%. Two other measures, reducing the eligible cost for facilities from $20 million to $10 million, again, accepting solar and other renewable manufacturing, which is treated separately, would still leave the tax credit an important incentive but reduce the revenue impact to the state. That would have the largest revenue impact. That would reduce the impact by as much as 20% for new projects. And finally, there is a requirement in state law that when a customer receives a federal grant and uses state tax credit, that the amount of that federal grant is reduced from the eligible cost for qualifying for the tax credit. So that reduces the amount of tax credit. We're proposing to treat grants from the Energy Trust, which is funded with the public purpose charge, the same way. We think that when it would help leverage both the state general fund and the public purpose charge more effectively and probably assure better coordination as well. We estimate that this measure could reduce revenue impacts by another 5 to 10%. So in total, I think we're looking at least in the range of 30 to 35% revenue reduction impact for new projects. We would have to, we haven't been done detailed runs yet that we'll do with your staff on integrating these four measures to see how they would play off against each other, but I think it would certainly avoid the large spike in the revenue impact that's projected for the next biennium and keep us on a more even keel in the future. At the same time, I think it would still maintain the program as an effective incentive program for both energy efficiency and renewable energy. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions or elaborate on any of these provisions.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps I'm a bit confused, but I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more. It sounds like there are still amendments forthcoming, and then if you could perhaps enlighten me a little bit more on the May decline that I see in the current bill, whether that continues to be the case in the amendments you're envisioning and how you might see that playing out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Reed, yes, there would be 3411 does not address the measures in the other three memos, and that's because the committee, our work group received those too late. Okay. So those have been, I understand, turned in for drafting for legislative council, but we haven't received those yet.
Okay.
Discretionary language, the May language in 3411, is intended to be there. It's intended in particular to focus on issues where under current law, the advice we have from our Attorney General's office is applications come in. If they meet the technical qualifications of the statute, we have no discretion to deny or reduce the amount of the tax credit. So this would give us that discretion subject to the criteria laid out in statute. We in turn would have to adopt rules that would specify those criteria a little more directly. But there is for example, multiple projects at the same site that has been a concern to a number of members. We currently have a series of applications pending for a total of 100 megawatts of wind that have been filed as 10 separate applications at essentially the same site. And that I think is not the intent of the legislature to provide 10 separate tax credits for that. One, perhaps two, but not certainly not 10. Under current law, we would probably not be able to make that kind of decision.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thanks. So do you envision that in those rules you might attach specific numeric sorts of criteria to, for example, A, the number of jobs? Would you have in mind that there would be a number, or do you have in mind that you would rank them, or could you say a little bit more about how that might work, please?
As Chairman Representative Reed, I think from the experience we've had on solar manufacturing facilities that do have a jobs benchmark, and there we've relied heavily on the Department of Economic Development, who are the real experts on economic impacts. We haven't used a specific number. Those have been negotiated with the companies specifically, but we have required a definite showing of impact, number of jobs, and then evaluated whether, given the costs and other potential benefits, if there are other economic benefits to the community, for example, where these projects are located, if those can show benefits, then that would be taken into account as well.
Thank you.
Quick clarifying question. So is it correct to say that on the March 13th memo that we have in front of us, that recommendation number 1 of 3 is essentially House Bill 3411, and that the other two recommendations on the March 13th memo and the recommendations in both of the March 19th memos are the pending amendments. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
That's correct. And maybe I should mention the one provision on the March 19th memo about electric vehicles. That was requested by our Economic Development Department. We've had some serious, they're having serious discussions with two electric vehicle and advanced battery manufacturers. And like solar manufacturers, these are bring lots of jobs. The current law only applies to renewable energy. We believe alternative fuel vehicles like these are essentially comparable facilities and should be treated the same way. And we think the revenue impact would be, we haven't scored it exactly yet, but we think it would be relatively small because our total of all renewable manufacturing facilities is about 10% of the revenue impact. This would be perhaps one or two more projects if we're successful. So it would be a few percent increase of the total program, not a lot, not compared to the reductions that these other amendments would bring.
Yes, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Graney, the items on 3, A, B, C, D, and E seem to be fairly broad, as Representative Reed pointed out when he mentioned jobs. I am just curious as to how the department would approach putting sideboards on those items A, B, C, D. I'm concerned about all of them, but C is an interesting one. The environmental impact of constructing and operating the facility I'm unclear on what the department would take into account, since there would be some environmental impact no matter what happened. What would the department be thinking as it was trying to write those rules?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, I think for environmental impacts in particular, we're talking about in terms of an adverse impact, a particularly sensitive area or particularly major environmental impact that can't be mitigated. I think on all of these, it would be a balancing versus the benefits, both the benefits and the revenue costs, and the environmental costs are one more factor. The economic benefits, jobs are one part of the equation. To the extent there's secondary benefits, such as increased whether it's tax payments, say for wind farms in rural communities, associated jobs with maintenance of facilities, related economic development, those would be factors on the plus side.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. And I'm going to ask that maybe you could address 2A. It indicates that you may not issue the preliminary certification unless the applicant has complied with all state and local requirements. Does that mean that the applicant has complied to that point in time, or are you looking forward through the entire process and saying before you can apply, you have to have acquired all your licenses and permits?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, actually, as the bill is currently drafted, it would require those permits to be acquired in advance. That may be something you want to look at as to whether we could, for example, condition the preliminary certification on compliance with those. I think that's a fair question for the committee to look at.
Probably one last question, Mr. Chair. And then I'm sorry to jump around like this, but on the next page, section 4 at the top, there's a provision that the Department of Revenue may not pay any interest on amounts claimed by the transferee. Can you explain to us what we're trying to address there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz. Again, that has a revenue reduction on the state as well. Currently, when a tax credit is transferred, so that the applicant gets the present value, gets essentially a cash grant for the project, and the tax credit is taken by another entity, and that tax credit is taken over 5 years, that does reduce the amount of taxes due, and in some cases, if it's in the current year, a company may have made quarterly payments, interest then would be owed by the state to that taxpayer. This provision would relieve the state of interest obligations on that. So it was one more way of looking for ways to reduce the revenue impact for the program.
Thank you.
I have a question that follows the line of Representative Bent's question, again on Section 3. We focused in a little bit on C, on the environmental impact. I'm also interested in hearing a little bit more about A, the number of jobs. Does your department currently have a method by which number of jobs are estimated? And how do you envision, through the rulemaking process, setting up ways to deal with the uncertainty that may happen in a projection of number of jobs?
Mr. Chairman, we do track the number of jobs created from industry sources and others, but we rely also on the Employment Department and especially on the Economic Development Department for what job expectations are for state investment as to what's a reasonable rate of return, if you will, for the state investment. And we would continue to do that and I think reflect that in our rules as well. But again, doing that rather than having a specific number per dollar amount in rule. I think an approach like that is not flexible doesn't reflect the realities of energy project development.
No, Representative Metz.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have some numbers from the projects that are already in play that would suggest what they're actually returning to our state for the investment we've made so far? And I'm talking about wind in particular.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, yes, we do. I think we have good information on both. It varies with technology. So, you know, we have wind farms. We also will have some biomass and cogeneration facilities. And in some cases, it's job retention and the large energy efficiency projects. So it can be job continuation as well as a new job creation. But we do have information on those.
Sure. Well, and where would I find that?
We can provide that to you. If you'd like, also Renewable Northwest Project, RNP, tracks the renewable energy projects in the Northwest and is a good source of information for a number of parameters like that, such as jobs created, taxes paid from renewable energy projects throughout Oregon and Washington.
Sure. On some of these projects, we've invested as much as $10 million or $11 million, and I'm just curious if you could share with us the type of return for that investment in the number of jobs, let's say, use any wind project.
In terms of, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, it will depend on the size of the project, and I would need to get back to you with specific examples, and we'd be glad to do that. I just don't know those off the top of my head. For wind farms, most of the jobs are in construction. It's a relatively few number of jobs for operation. For industrial biomass and cogeneration, there's more jobs involved in operation as well. So it varies. As some of the other renewable technologies, such as solar photovoltaics, become viable, we'll have a different job mix composition there as well.
Please. I'm interested because we've had this conversation a number of times over the last 60 days, and the numbers for local communities, that is the return to their tax base, the numbers of long-term jobs, and the numbers of construction dollars spent seem to be relatively small compared to the state's investment. So it would be greatly interesting to, I think, all of us to see those numbers.
Yes, we'll get those to you as quickly as we can and get in from encourage other sources to do that as well.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. one of the things we haven't discussed at this point is, in particular, wind farms. Their maturity level has come a long way. When we started this, we were looking at wind farms that may or may not ever be built if we didn't encourage them. But with the maturity, I'm wondering how much that's true anymore. And as a second question, if one of the things we want to do is encourage this kind of energy development, whether or not it's in this state would depend, in my mind, on what the economic benefits to the state are. And do we want to continue to encourage a very developed company or industry? You know, what are your thoughts about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I believe we should continue to do so.
Okay.
I think there are benefits to large wind farms, to rural Oregon particularly, but also as we've had negotiations with the solar manufacturers, which do bring a large number of jobs, long-term jobs. Mm-hmm. One of the things they have all continually asked us is, Do we have a renewable portfolio standard? Do we have, which we didn't have until 2007, do we have incentives for individuals to use renewable energy? Do we have renewable energy being built and used in Oregon? And it doesn't matter just solar. They consider themselves part of renewable energy industry, so the presence of a large number of wind turbines has been a positive thing even in our solar recruitment.
Okay.
And we are having active discussions with some of the wind manufacturers as well. We've been unsuccessful so far in getting a manufacturing facility, although Vestas is developing a large corporate headquarters that will bring more jobs to the state as well. And we're still hopeful that we'll be able to get component manufacturing and major service facilities for the wind farms in Oregon that would provide more jobs for the operation phase. So I think on balance it's important that we continue this incentive for wind and other large renewable energy. I do think it's reasonable to take a look at how much we offer, and I think the menu of options you have here is a reasonable way to significantly reduce the revenue impact but still have an effective incentive.
That's helpful. Thank you.
If you don't mind, I'd like to return for a moment to my favorite section, Section 3, on this, on 3411, and continue that line of questioning. I'm curious on the jobs criteria, whether or not there currently is or whether you envision to be a method by which you could scale the impact of a job on a local community through geographical differences in the state.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that there are formulas the Economic Development Department uses and for impacts of jobs in a given industry. So we would avail ourselves of that.
Thank you. And on 3C, on the environmental impact, you discussed this. Perhaps you already addressed this and I missed it. It would appear to me that that would also allow a process by which your department could introduce consideration of carbon impact criteria into the Betsy beyond what is intended in the immediate installation of a particular renewable energy facility. Is that the case?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think the environmental impact includes the environmental benefits as well as environmental adverse impacts. And that's something to keep in mind because the default, if we don't have renewable energy, is either natural gas, which is very variable in terms of price fluctuation, or coal, which has significantly more adverse impacts, whether the coal is located in-state or not.
And does the phrase operating the facility imply a consideration of the life cycle cost of the manufacturer as well, or not?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we had in mind the life cycle cost of the manufacturing components.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions from the committee, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate your hard work on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to go ahead and call up Lewis Payne and Jody Weiser.
For the record, my name is Jody Weiser, Thatch Furnace, Oregon. The page you're getting that is colored is a page from the website that Dr. Graney suggested might look at to see what kind of benefits come from wind energy projects. It's the it's on the front page, and it is rather old. It's got a January 2007 date, and it is for projects throughout the Northwest, not just Oregon. However, it talks about 954 megawatts of power, and we have 1,000 megawatts of power installed in Oregon, and another over 3,000 megawatts in the planning stages, and you know, they've got preliminary certification, they're going to get built, so this is really a good example of where we're going. So in Oregon, if you build 1,000 megawatts of power, that's usually going to be set up as 9 or maybe 10 separate wind farms. Usually they have about 100 megawatts each, and usually we give them $11 million each for that wind farm, that for each 100 megawatts. So for this 1,000 megawatts of power, we will have given out about $100 million. So the question is, what do you get for that $100 million, which is a really sizable investment from the government? Well, if you look at point number two on that chart, it says that you get between $2 and $3 million in annual royalty payments to rural landowners. Now, sometimes they lease the land, sometimes they make royalty payments, but in either case, it's income to the farmer. And if you multiply $3 million times our 9% tax rate, that means we're going to get about $270,000 a year in taxable tax return max from that $100 million investment. So that's not a very good return on investment if you look at that as one of the ways the state is getting something back. And obviously, it isn't our job to give money to farmers, so that the fact that the farmers are getting the royalty payments isn't the point. The fact that we're getting some return back in income taxes would be. At item number three, it says there'll be roughly 80 family wage jobs for operations and maintenance once these projects are built. Well, that means that the state's paying $1.2 million per job. If we figure that those jobs are costing, are paying in benefits and salary about $70,000 each, that means that the state is paying all of the salaries for 17 years. Well, that's a pretty heavy investment in those facilities. And the other thing to look at is the property taxes that are received by the local communities. The local communities are, these projects are mostly being built in situations where there's huge tax advantages. So they're not really collecting property taxes on all of that investment. They're collecting property taxes on about 25% of the investment value. So if you look down at number four, it says that Union County expects to receive $10 million over the next 20 years from just this one project. So they're going to get $10 million back over the next 20 years from the $11 million that we provided to the wind farm. It seems like it'd be more direct to just give the $11 million to the county instead, if that's the return on investment we're trying to get. We think that you need to look seriously at whether Betsy's are essential for wind. The evidence has not been brought forward that proves that it's needed, that this is not a mature industry, as Representative Riley suggested, and that it isn't ready to stand on its own. Washington State has been subsidizing the wind farms by giving them a sales tax break. That is costing the state about $4.5 million for all of their wind farms, and they're considering removing that subsidy. So we're not the only ones, and we actually have the most generous subsidy in the country for wind. We think that we don't need any. You can provide $100 million to wind farms in the next biennium, or you can provide $100 million in Oregon Opportunity Grants. That's what we gave out in the last biennium in Oregon Opportunity Grants. You could provide $100 million to wind farms, or you can keep 15 elementary schools open for the next biennium. It's unlikely that you can do all three. The budget situation is such that we're going to have to make choices, and we think you need to consider very seriously whether this is the best place to be spending this kind of money. You have to be sure it's a good trade-off, and you have to be convinced that you can justify it to the voters of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Payne, did you have something to add?
No.
Great. Are there questions from the committee?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I wish to address 3411.
Please.
Are there questions from Mrs. Weiser?
Not seeing you. Please proceed. Representative Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have one question. Jody, did you have a chance to contact Union County to see what they actually are receiving? Because I see this is 2 years old. And
I hadn't thought to do that. That's a good idea. I know that there's been a good bit of controversy. I've read articles in the paper where wind farms thought they were, I mean, the local community thought they were going to get a certain amount of money, and they're actually getting less because the wind farms in a rural enterprise zone, and so they don't get anything for the first 3 years, and then by the time they start collecting money, the value of the asset is depreciated so much that they're not getting what they thought they would get. But some are in SIPs, some are in enterprise zones, some are getting deals with the counties that they're working with that are separate from those kind of zones, and so it is going to be different from place to place, but I think that's a very good question.
Thank you.
Mr. Payne, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Lewis Payne, registered lobbyist, affiliated with Tax Fairness Oregon, and I wish to address at this time House Bill 3411. We are in favor of the bill. We wish to suggest that you take a look at certain modifications as it is now written. The first point we'd like to make is that the bill as it now stands is for larger entities, $5 million and above. In this day and age, it may seem almost quaint to think back to the time when we heard that quip about $1 million here, $1 million there. Sooner or later, it adds up to real money. However, if we are thinking in terms of 35% or 50% subsidies, that means we're talking about tax subsidies of $1.75 million up to $2.5 million. It is our feeling that this is a substantial amount of money, and that perhaps the definition of a larger entity should be lowered to reflect the additional income that could be saved. Whether or not we go as far down as $1 million or $2 million would be a decision made by the committee, but we feel that $5 million is a threshold that should be lowered. Our second point was that if you look on Section 2 and 2B, it talks about the qualifications and for elimination of businesses, and we would suggest that in addition to all taxes being paid and that type of thing, that the provision also eliminate businesses that have records of bad business practice or environmental issues. We have in the state in the last few years a case of a company that leaving a toxic waste site to be cleaned up, later returned and applied for subsidies again. We think in addition to the taxes, the bill might be better written to include say unemployment benefits, abuses, and environmental issues. One of the points that has been brought up repeatedly already this morning is the question of jobs. We would like to suggest that this should not be a concern of the DOE, but it be a concern of you members. This is a public policy issue as we see it, and we would suggest that perhaps this type of criteria for jobs, the number of jobs appropriate for the site, and the wages and benefit packages for the sites, would be better served, this aspect, if taken away from DOE and used as a policy measure and formulated by the committee. As is written now, I say DOE sets the number. We suggest you should. The next point we want to take a look at is another one that's also was raised by Director Ganey. This whole question of the sites, when you have multiple entities on the site, combining them into one, And whether or not, our question is, we wonder whether or not this is going to be feasible if it's challenged and goes through the courts. And we would suggest that there may be a necessity here to have a very tightly written provision in the law, in the bill, that would alleviate, to some extent, the possibility that at a later date that we're going to be faced with a problem of the general fund falling victim to unexpected costs for the Betsy credits. Finally, we have one last suggestion for modification of the bill. Under a current Betsy, under the current situation, the Betsy can change the subsidy. It may bring it down if under certain conditions. And our question is, since the main condition is that the economy is down, has the economy situation as it stands now been evaluated, and can we at this point go ahead and lower these subsidies? It is our suggestion that perhaps instead of may, the wording should be changed to shall. In addition to which, we believe this provision should be extended to other Betsy applications, not just manufacturing facilities. With these points taken and considered, we believe that House Bill 3411 should be passed. We thank you for your time.
Thank you. Committee, are there questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both for your testimony. I'm going to go ahead and call up Suzanne Lita Liu and Elon Hassan.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bailey. My name is Suzanne Lita Liu. I'm the Senior Policy Advocate at Renewable Northwest Project. I'd like to provide this opportunity. I'm going to speak briefly, and then I'm really happy to answer questions. I think there's been a lot of questions about the value of renewable energy projects to the state of Oregon, the value of the state's money. And so I think it's important to help address some of those questions, and I'll try to do that. But I'm also want to provide this as a forum to be able to do that as well or meet with any of you individually. There's a lot that's new on the table right now that's been proposed by the Department of Energy that we haven't seen before. What we have seen is 3411, and so I can testify to that particular bill. As far as these other amendments and what we have on paper from the Department of Energy, I can speak to some of our concerns and some important issues, I think, for the committee to consider when they're drafting amendments. And I think it's important to think carefully about all of these amendments, including 3411. For those of you who just don't know, as a quick reminder, Renewable Northwest Project is a nonprofit organization. We're a coalition of public interest groups, including consumer and environmental groups, and renewable energy companies. We represent a broad spectrum of different interest groups when we testify before you today. We do think, and we've testified before, that the Betsy in its current form is an essential tool to growing Oregon's renewable energy market. That tool is critically important for wind in particular, for rural communities, for rural economic development. It's unfortunate today that we don't have someone who can testify specifically from a rural community before you. They usually travel from pretty far, as Representative Bentz knows, but I think if you had that opportunity, you'd hear that loud and clear, and Elon from Horizon can speak to that a bit. But the Betsy in its current form essentially makes the case, when a project developer is looking at developing in different places, it makes the case for a developer to develop here in Oregon, to actually build a project here in Oregon versus build it in another state. And that's especially important given our current financial market. There's a limited amount of capital, and so every bit of difference makes a difference for whether a project actually gets built in Oregon. So, for example, we have about 1,000 megawatts in the ground right now. There's about 2,300 megawatts of wind. I'm just talking about wind. I can speak to solar and other types of renewables, but just for wind in particular, we have about 1,000 megawatts in the ground. We have about 2,300 megawatts in the pipeline. So that's projects that are either under construction, in the permitting, have been permitted for construction or in the permitting process. There's a few of those that are actually under construction right now. Most are have in the permitting or process or have been permitted. But that doesn't mean that those projects will necessarily get built. And so the Betsy, especially in comparison to the sales tax exemption in Washington, for example, or other state tax credits, makes the difference. It helps a developer make the case that their investors should build here in Oregon and make sure Oregon gets those benefits. Speak to just the rural benefits, for example, on average, about 100 megawatt facility creates about 200 construction jobs. And we've seen that because so many projects are getting built here in Oregon, those part-time construction jobs often turn into full-time positions because you see the same construction workers who have skills and experience in building projects move from one project to the next. But every 100-megawatt project generates about 200 construction jobs, and depending on the size of the project, roughly speaking, around the 100-megawatt level is about a dozen full-time O&M positions. And we have programs in the state like the Columbia Gorge Community College that trains full-time O&M staff specifically for wind projects, and we want to see programs like that expand in the state of Oregon. In fact, that program is so popular that often the Community Gorge Community College, Columbia Gorge Community College, has trouble retaining their students because there is so much job demand in our region. So, speaking to that in particular, that's the kinds of jobs that we're talking about. For local counties, it's the thing that is the number one most important thing for them is the local tax benefits. These counties are losing their local tax income left and right, and they need those local tax benefits to be able to keep their schools running, to keep their services and programs moving along. You know, if Steve Grassi was here, Judge Grassi from Harney County, you know, he in particular sees the value of that benefit. In addition to that, local farmers and ranchers, when they have wind generated on their property, they receive lease payments. And those lease payments, in many cases, allows those ranchers and farmers to be able to keep ranching and farming, in particular for ranching. So those lease payments are an important economic benefit as well. And then finally, there are additional kind of added economic benefits from getting O&M staff and construction staff in, you know, building projects in the area. They spend money on local restaurants. They kind of essentially give a boost to the local community. And all of those things are, I think, are critically important. And the direction that we want to move in, and this kind of legislation, the tax credit on its own, is a critical thing that, again, that gets those projects built and gets those results for the state of Oregon. And keeping that all in mind, you know, we understand the state has a tough budget and, you know, a difficult revenue situation. And so we want to be reasonable when we look at the tax credit and when we talk to our membership. And I think that all of you are doing that too. 3411, just the number one in the Department of Energy's memo to you, so specifically focusing on projects over $5 million, making sure the Department of Energy can look at things like jobs and environmental benefits and make sure projects are operating for at least 5 years. Those are reasonable approaches to the tax credit. And so we want to let you know that we're supportive of those reasonable approaches. I think that it would be on the $5 million, the five-year requirement, it seems that it would be better to put that in the hands of ODO rules. So if that can be considered, we would encourage that. And then we do have some concerns about, well, we have actually some strong concerns about numbers 2 and 3 in the Department of Energy's memo. So just briefly, again, I think it's important to focus on 3411, but to let you know We have some concerns around eliminating the provision that allows projects to qualify for up to 10% more. The main reason why they do that right now is because when a developer submits a preliminary certification to the department, they give an estimated cost, and those costs can change. And so by the time they get a final certification, which can be, I don't know, maybe 6 months later, or maybe later than be after that, the final project costs are different. So this allows for some increase depending on what the final costs are. And the only concern that we have is we're not sure if this 10% difference makes a huge difference or not. I mean, obviously everything makes a difference, but it may not. We don't want it to encourage developers to submit preliminary certifications for higher numbers than the reality. So just be aware of some of the potential consequences of that. Maybe it's not a potential consequence, but you know, we want to be careful there. And then in terms of number three, you know, this is the first time I've seen a proposal to even consider reducing the limit of eligible costs for energy generation. You know, it's the one thing I would stress is if you are looking at the Betsy, it is critically important to look at it holistically. Look at how the Betsy affects manufacturing and affects energy generation. It's both of those tools together that grow our market, and so you don't want to cut one without thinking about the other or vice versa. We have just general concerns about targeting a particular project type when you think about modifying the Betsy. And I think in general, you know, we would likely oppose three. I think it's enough of a significant difference where we could see projects just not moving forward. I think that's pretty likely. So I'll leave it at that. And I will note just in closing that we are updating our fact sheet about economic development in the region. It's almost there. We're just waiting on a couple of additional numbers. Right now in the Northwest, we have over 2,700 megawatts installed. That's of renewable energy, so that includes solar and geothermal. About 3% of our total load in the Northwest is coming from renewable energy sources right now. And so the fact sheet, I gave you some general numbers about what a 100 megawatt project looks like, but the fact sheet will actually give you very explicit numbers on a project by project basis, so that you have a better sense of what each individual project, what the results are for those projects in terms of economic development. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and hear from Mr. Hassan, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Elon Hassan. I'm a developer, project manager with Horizon Wind Energy. Horizon Wind Energy is the fourth largest developer of wind energy in the country. We own, operate, develop, and construct wind farms, and we have two and a half currently operating in Oregon and several in Washington. In the pipeline in Washington, rather. I want to start by saying thank you for letting me come here and testify, and that, you know, the first blush impression is the Betsy's worked great. It's a wonderful policy, and it's made a huge impact for development in Oregon. The second is really appreciate the committee's work. We support 3411. Appreciate the members here and Mr. Graney for working to come up with a compromise bill. We're happy with 3411 as drafted and think it goes in the right direction. Sends the right signal to the marketplace as a whole that Oregon is a good place to come to develop wind projects, and that's critical. Part of what Suzanne was saying earlier is very true in terms of, you know, what's in the pipeline, some 2,300 megawatts of electricity. It's really not a foregone conclusion. Those are all going to get built. It's a competitive marketplace. And just last year, we saw a project in Washington that was, we'd slated from our headquarters to have turbines go to, and those turbines went to the Midwest because that project was more competitive. We work very hard to develop the projects here, and I think most of the projects will get built. I don't know how much of a question of if, but more a question of when those things happen. So we support 3411. I continue to I can't remember how the staff person represented the general lack of positive feelings about 24/7/2. I would continue to echo those lack of positive feelings for it. And
so noted.
Thank you.
Is it possible to make one final point
Please.
About the emissions reduction? Thank you, Vice Chair Bailey. This is just new information, so I want to share it with all of you. We took a look at the projects that are in the ground and the projects in the pipeline in terms for just for wind for emissions reduction value. And we compared that. We compared those emissions reduction value numbers to our 1990 numbers, which are what the states, and just specifically greenhouse gas emissions. So what the states, we worked with 1990 because that's what the state's existing greenhouse gas emission reduction goals are based upon. And we found that the projects in the ground and the projects in the pipeline, which is about, you know, roughly 3,300 megawatts, is about 3.2% of our 1990 emissions. And our emissions grew from 1990 to 2000 by about 12%. So the total amount of projects in the ground and in the pipeline are actually greater emissions reductions than the amount of growth between 1990 and 2000. So we're talking about significant emissions reduction value to achieve our state's greenhouse gas emissions goals. Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elon, your company, you said, has wind farms in Oregon and Washington. Can you repeat, you know, what you have in Oregon and what you have in Washington for me?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley. We have we constructed the Wild Horses project in Washington, and that's we sold that to Puget Sound. That was about 3 or 4 years ago. And we also have the Elkhorn project in Union County, the Rattlesnake Road project in Arlington, and Wheatfield project, which will soon go online. That was the half it might be online now. I'm not sure. It's almost done with construction.
Well,
so how much generation from wind farms that your company built is in each state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I think, well, this is in here, I think Wild Horse is 200 megawatts.
That's close.
It's close to 200 megawatts. And Elkhorn is about 100, Rattlesnake's about 100, and Wheatfield's about 100.
And so?
300 megawatts in Oregon and about 200 in Washington.
Well,
so the Betsy is significantly more beneficial than the Washington subsidy.
Actually, it's not the case.
That's where I'm going. Is that the case? And if it is the case, why did you build in Washington? If it's not the case, you know, why do we keep thinking it is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley. There are a lot of factors that go into building a wind farm. The first and foremost is the wind resource. How windy is a specific place? Because everything else you can mitigate for, but depending on how strong the wind blows in a specific space with a specific turbine layout is really determinative. That's going to be the main factor. Everything after that is going to be the policies that you create around it. What are the environmental impacts? What mitigation do you have to have for wildlife? What's the transmission cost? How far is it? How close is it to a transmission line? So wind is probably the most important factor, but after that, everything else goes into making it happen. And often, a big part of that is are things like the Betsy. Now, I don't remember. Is it? I don't know what the tax impact is of the Betsy compared to the sales tax exemption. But Suzanne might.
What we've been when told, we're working on both issues in both states, and what we've been told is that current Washington sales tax exemption is actually three times the value of the state Betsy. But again, it's the combination. It's the regional market and the fact that the Betsy exists that is helping to get projects built here too. They're both of value, but currently the Washington sales tax exemption, from what we've been told, is of greater value.
And I generally work on Oregon projects, and I know, you know, in particular in Union County, an active county commission who works really hard to work through the permitting process was a huge help. It's little things like that. The local community support can make a huge difference in getting a wind project built, and so I think a lot of the credit should go to, you know, the rural Oregon communities who've been really helpful. Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elon, great to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
My question, we're spending a lot of our conversation today talking about production, energy production. Of course, that's where wind has been so tied in. But I think it's important for our overall conversation to remember that the Betsy has an equal impact on manufacturing, and that's where we see the benefit in solar and PV and whatnot. My question is let me preface it with a hope and a desire, at least for me personally, is that Oregon become, and I know it's on the path, but become not only a leader of renewable energy production and manufacturing in the nation, but perhaps the leader. We've probably not on purpose, but we've seen a lot of our old line industries go, or at least on their way out, and that's distressing. But here's an opportunity, with tomorrow's technologies and tomorrow's needs and demands, where Oregon can be not only a leader but the leader. And so my question is a broader one. Does the Betsy get us there? And I'm sure eliminating the Betsy, and that's not what we're talking about, but I'm sure eliminating that doesn't get us there. But with some of the restrictions or sideboards that we're contemplating, can we still get to that point? First of all, can the Betsy get us to where I'm advocating we need to be? And secondly, if we put up these sideboards that are being deliberated, is that going to inhibit our ability to do that?
You can go first.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin. I think, as I said earlier, the Betsy sends a critical signal to the marketplace that Oregon is very interested in renewable energy development. I showed to this committee, but I think Oregon has its wind resource in terms of cumulative wind energy is about the middle of the pack of the country. Okay, it's good, but it's not the best, not the worst. Yet Oregon's in the top 10 of developed wind energy. And, why does Vestas decide to locate its national headquarters in Portland? It's not the windiest state. They're not going to move the most turbines immediately here. I mean, there's a ton of energy in the Midwest. But they come here, and I think it's because of policies like the Betsy. It's because of what we've said we want to do. The sentiments that you're echoing today, I think, are exactly the kind of things that get us there. In terms of the specific policies in the Betsy, is that everything we need to get there? I'm not sure, but I think what you said is best. If you were to, get rid of the Betsy, that would certainly send a very clear negative signal. And I think, Comrades in 3411, sending those ideas to the marketplace that we're interested in this kind of renewable development, we're interested in new proposals of how we get there. I mean, I think that's what people are looking for.
Yeah, I think I would just echo that. The Betsy and the renewable portfolio standard combined, it's really those two things that are driving the market, and that's both for manufacturing and for energy generation, and we need those two things together. I think Director Graney put it very well, that it's a combination of those two things that really make it grow. And I think that I do have strong concerns about numbers 2 and 3 on this particular memo from the department, specifically because I have concerns that would impact the market, and I don't want to do that. But I do think that 3411, as it's been drafted before you, is a reasonable approach, and I don't have the same level of concern about that particular bill.
So would it be? Yes, Representative Call.
Thank you. Representative Bruin has piqued my interest. So I'd like to dig a little deeper on his question and try to see if you have. I guess my concern with the Betsy is kind of the opposite side of how much it costs, but rather, are we getting as much bang for our buck as possible? I'm wondering if there is ideas out there, if you guys have thoughts for how we grow the renewable energy economy more quickly. Instead of talking about cutting the Betsy or trimming it down here on one side or the other, how do we spur innovation? How do we get greater research and development? How do we push our economy forward with this tool, and is it possible? Just wondering if you guys have any thoughts on that.
Well, that I sit on the Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group, and that's what we talk about. The point of the group is to try to think about, okay, what are the next steps forward beyond what we have in place right now? There are some major constraints to renewable energy development and manufacturing that the state that the state can do. Just a couple of examples, certainly for energy development, are transmission. We definitely need better transmission and more lines to be able to access these energy resources in rural areas. So that's an issue that we've talked about for sure. We work diligently. We have a full-time staff person that essentially works on transmission and another person that works on integration and integrating renewable resources into our grid system and developing tools to be able to do that cost-effectively is another really important issue. Wind energy siting, getting siting policy right, is another key issue. And then, in terms of kind of new technologies and innovation, we agree that that's really important for the state to work with our educational systems, both in terms of research and development, and to be able to get the right kinds of funding for research and development, and to partner with industries to make things happen and get outside capital investment to get projects to go. But it's also we also really need more of a workforce, a skilled, trained workforce. We have a program right now on our staff to work with community colleges and our university system to grow, to basically help grow their curriculum, develop their curriculum to train the right kind of staff to work with this industry. And so I would kind of, if I were to say those sort of four things, I think those are some key issues that we haven't quite tackled enough yet.
If I follow up?
Yeah, please. One last question, just because you guys have such a deep experience in this area. I'm wondering, so much of what we're doing with the Betsy is for lack of a better word, is direct subsidy of industry to try to drive down the cost of this product or the fixed cost or the sunk cost of doing these endeavors. I'm wondering, is there something more we can do on the other side of the ledger, which is to say, is there a way that we can create a greater economy in the state of Oregon for solar or for this technology or for renewable energy? Are there things that we can be doing that create the marketplace for the kinds of energy, renewable energies that the kinds of technologies we're creating, such that we're not just producing solar, but we've actually created a great environment for the installation and utilization of those solar panels. Could you speak to that as well?
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that issue as you were speaking because I was thinking of a fifth, and that would be for a solar market. We have if you're in an IOU service territory, so you get an energy trust rebate. And you can get the Betsy or the Retsy, then solar can work very well. But you need a couple things, too. You need to have some upfront capital to make it work well. And a lot of people don't necessarily have that level of upfront capital, whether they're businesses or individual residents. And if you're not in an IOU service territory and you don't get an energy trust rebate, it makes it very difficult to do solar. So if you're in I should actually be clear, EWEB has excellent solar energy programs, and some of our municipal utilities, like at EWEB and Ashland in particular, do have very good rebates. But many of the others, if they don't have good programs, it's just difficult because the finances are so large. Barriers are large. Now, the long-term benefits of solar, just like wind or any other renewable energy resource, are important. There's no fuel cost. So they are renewables make financial sense for consumers. But nevertheless, the upfront installation costs of solar in comparison to other renewables, are significantly higher. We're seeing prices go down just even in the past year, but they're still not quite there yet in terms of cost parity with other conventional sources on the grid or even other renewable sources. I think that continuation of the energy trust programs and the Betsy is critically important, but there are some tools that we can use to help improve those programs. The pilot program for production-based incentives it's HB 2121 as is now, as it is in its current form now, is a really a great way. It's a great tool to try and just look at other options for making solar work better in the state. Representative Bailey's bill can help make sure loans are more accessible to people to be able to install renewables, and more importantly for that bill, I think, to install energy efficiency. So there's lots of opportunity that we have to be able to better get the incentives and the loan programs that we have right now out into the hands of the public and help them work in different ways.
And I would note, committee, and for those in the audience and those at home, that many of these topics will be discussed even perhaps later today and in upcoming hearings in Representative Reed's Sustainability and Economic Development Committee. So I encourage your attendance there as well. Are there other questions from the committee on this bill? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. I'd like to go ahead and call up John Charles. And is there anybody else who would like to be heard today on these bills?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute. I have a couple comments I'd like to make. One is I support the general direction of House Bill 3411, but I think Section 2, Sub 3 is completely unworkable. A number of you have raised questions today about it. When I look at lines 22 through 27, page 1, I don't understand what they mean. And I think if you keep the bill this way, you're just delegating away a huge amount of authority to Mr. Graney. And I have a lot of respect for Mr. Graney and the people who work for him. But a comment was made earlier about sideboards for this. Well, I think you should decide, what do these criteria mean? If that's the direction you want to go in, set the policy. Don't delegate it, because this means whatever folks at ODO want it to mean, I guess. I can't figure it out. But I do think anything you can do to minimize the fiscal effect of wind power is a good thing. But I also think that to some degree, this is a very convoluted and somewhat misguided way to get at the more fundamental problem, which probably is not purely under the jurisdiction of this committee, which is, why would you subsidize large wind at all? Sure, if you pick a specific winner, you can create jobs, and some people benefit from that. And as Ms. Weiser said, you could just ship some cash to counties, or you could build pyramids. You can employ people that way. But from the standpoint of the actual grid that is running this building, large wind facilities, they're unreliable. They have surges. You can't use them for base load. You never will use them for base load. And the people who actually run the grid, who have to keep supply and demand in equilibrium at all times and have maybe 4 seconds to adjust when there's a big power surge or a drop before the grid has a catastrophic failure, large wind plants are really just a nuisance, as would be the case with the waves or big solar. You can't run base loads there. So I don't even know why you want to subsidize this stuff at all. It's a sideshow. And I think, really, from the standpoint of the developers, there's only three reasons to build wind plants. One is huge federal and state subsidies. Two, RPS mandates to provide a guaranteed market. And three, speculative expectation that states, regions, or the federal government will, through cap-and-trade legislation, create a carbon cartel and form essentially a new currency literally out of thin air. And Warren Buffett and his Mid-America Energy a couple years ago did an analysis showing that they can make money from a wind farm if they never generate any power at all. Well, I'm sure that's good for some people. I don't understand what that does for people just trying to run a building or a company. So, you know, all you're doing really, you're not going to power down a coal plant or a nuclear plant when there's a wind surge. All you do is displace low-cost, reliable hydropower with high cost, unreliable wind power at the margin. Again, some people do benefit from that. From the standpoint of the whole grid, there's no benefit. And I think what we're headed towards is essentially what the experience California had between 1980 and 2000. No new baseload facilities, shut some down, spend billions of dollars in demand-side management renewables, and by December of 2000, have some brownouts, the blackouts. And then the governor, Gray Davis, quickly became the ex-governor of California. So, you know, there are some things, a question was raised earlier about what could we do to promote some markets. I think there are a couple things. You could legalize nuclear power in Oregon again. Now, that's base load. That's carbon-free. Very low environmental impact. That's a discussion worth having, at least, about whether we should do it. You could allow energy recovery facilities like the Brooks garbage burner to qualify as renewable power under the RPS standard. In my way of thinking, municipal solid waste is a renewable power source, unless someone thinks household garbage is about to drop to zero sometime soon. and you could reduce corporate tax rates significantly or eliminate them across the board to encourage the trillions of dollars of investment capital circling the globe looking for a safe landing to land in Oregon. I'm sure there's thousands of science geeks out there hoping to be the next Jack Kilby, the co-inventor of the microprocessor, or the next Thomas Edison, or the next Bill Gates. Invite them to be in Oregon with low taxation rates and toil away in a garage or lab somewhere and bring forth something we can't even imagine through low tax rates. And don't pick winners and losers. Let investors put their cash at risk, and we reap the benefits and the employment. Now, that, I think, would be a sustainable tax policy for the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Before we take questions from Mr. Charles, I want to recognize Senator Nelson. Did you want to be heard on this?
I'm just here with a student from Guthrie International. I'm just seeing what's going on.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. Are there questions for Mr. Charles? Mm-hmm. Seeing none. And while you're giving your testimony, Brock, Joe, if you want to come up.
Thank you, Representative Bailey and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell, and I'm an advocate for Environment Oregon. And we work to represent our 30,000 members to protect clean air, clean water, and open space. And I'd just like to make two points. One is the broader context of why we have the Betsy. We have a goal of reducing our projected global warming pollution by 80% by 2050. Our current policies, as they stand now, prior to this legislative session of us passing anything, we will not even achieve about half of where we need to go. From what I understand, the DOE's projections limiting the Betsy credit to $5 million projects and above limits it to about 78% of the projects, at least in the past. So that means 22% of our projects wouldn't be funded, at least if we had this retroactively passed. I don't know if that'd be the case in the future, but certainly that's worrisome from our point of view. So we need as many good policies as we can to be able to move our state towards that goal. The second point I'd like to make is we just had the recent estimates out for unemployment rates in rural counties, and at least three counties are very close to 20% unemployment rate. And to be limiting the types of projects that we're having only worsens the problem that we have in rural counties. So with that, I yield my time, and thank you.
Are there questions for Mr. Howell? Not seeing any. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Esmond.
Yes. Excuse me. Good morning, committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I am a business agent for the IBEW Local 48 in Portland, Oregon. And in front of you, you have a handout. Very brief, and I'll just be very briefly say that you keep hearing about untrained workforce. Where are we going to find the workers? I think the handout is self-explanatory. 1,300 people trained in solar. If I have 15 people working on solar today in the state of Oregon, I'd be surprised. The windmills, we work on the Horizon projects, the Klondikes, we do all the lines. So wave and hydro, energy efficiency stuff, I'll be flying down to L.A. in June, working with our contractors and union down there to have our electricians do energy audits in houses and on commercial buildings. We are ahead of the curve. We always state we're going to stay ahead of the curve. We provide training, and as a sidebar, we are self-funded. So we have the skilled workforce to do any of this work, so I just want to bring that out to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having been on the Workforce and Economic Development Committee for the last two sessions, I want to say that the apprentice programs and other educational programs that these folks provide are absolutely essential to our workforce development in this state. And you know, while they can't replace the community colleges and universities, they certainly fill a much-needed role, and I think they're to be congratulated for doing that.
Mm-hmm. Not seeing other questions. Thank you all very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee.
Not seeing anyone else who wishes to be heard, committee, thank you for your indulgence today. I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bills 3411 and House Bills 2472. And, committee, I would like to for the record, acknowledge Representative Bentz, who, in consultation with Chair Barnhart, let me take the keys to the car today, so I appreciate that. we'll see if that happens again. And with that, the House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.